to march to the right, basically adopting the policies of Donald Trump. We have a very different approach. In our view, the most important thing that we can do to fix the crisis of migration is to stop causing it in the first place through regime change operations, through economic neocolonialism and domination, through the climate crisis, and through the war on drugs. There are things that we can do actually right now that will decompress the pressures that are pushing people to seek refuge at our borders. And that includes, on day one of our administration, we would legalize marijuana and undercut the power of the drug cartels to basically cause violence and wreak havoc on so many nations, particularly south of the border. We would not be overturning other democratically elected administrations, like, for example, the Aristide presidency of Haiti, which we overturned twice. And after doing that, the U.S., under Hillary Clinton's Secretary of State administration, went in and reversed a minimum wage law that had raised the minimum wage from a pathetic 30 cents an hour merely to 60 cents an hour. And that was reversed by the power of the U.S. once we had overthrown the democratically elected government of Haiti. So, you know, it's no surprise with all the crises that the U.S. has been behind with our economic domination, our neocolonialism, our regime change operations, our war on drugs south of the border in particular, and also with our failure to actually take real concrete steps on the climate crisis, and that in turn is prompting so many millions of farmers to have to flee because they have no way of supporting themselves because of rampant drought and other climate instability. There is so much that we can do, not only to mitigate our own production of fossil fuels, which has skyrocketed actually under Democratic administrations far more than it has under the Republican administrations, and which are not adequately addressed by the Inflation Reduction Act, which is more a fossil fuels first bill, if we have time to go into that. But we are not taking care of, you know, the many solutions we could provide right now, which would decompress the crisis at the border. And the last thing to say here is that instead of spending billions of dollars on a wall, which only kills people, kills wildlife, destroys ecosystems, instead we can be investing those dollars into prompt screening, background checks, and to providing work papers for people promptly at the border. Because once migrants have crossed into this country and once they're papered and can work, they are an economic boon to any community and are worth trillions of dollars, actually, in economic development. Our communities would be competing for migrants rather than shutting them out if migrants were able to get to work. They not only, you know, pay their way, they actually contribute enormously to economic development and to the tax base of any community.
And Dr. Stein, I wanted to follow up. You were talking earlier about Gaza. This month, the Council on American Islamic Relations, CAIR, published a poll that shows you are ahead of Kamala Harris among Muslim voters in key swing states like Michigan, Arizona, and Wisconsin. But yet the National Uncommitted Movement, which decided not to endorse any of the two major party candidates, also decided not to endorse any third party candidates. Wondering your response.
American and the Muslim American community is not simply uniform, but the CAIR polls were quite comprehensive. So uncommitted is a smaller subset of that larger community. And it's very clear what the sentiment of the larger community is. They're absolutely up in arms because so many of their family members have been killed. You know, people who have lost tens or scores or even hundreds of family members. It would be a simple matter for the Democrats to recoup those votes if they wanted to. But it's more important to them to continue the genocide in Gaza than it is to win this election. And without the support of the Muslim vote, they will not win this election, and they cannot. So it's in their hands. They have the power to actually do what it would take to win back that very alienated and distraught vote, which is not coming to the Democrats as long as they continue to carry out this genocide. So it's on them. This is not something they can blame third parties on. They have lost that support. And the American people and the people of the world, you know, deserve an option which is actually consistent with the majority of American opinion, not just Muslim opinion, but the majority of American opinion opinion around the world.
Before you selected Butcher Ware as your running mate, several high-profile Palestinian and Arab rights activists said they were approached by your team, including Abed Ayoub, the director of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, and Palestinian-American lawyer and professor Noura Erekat. Professor Erekat tweeted, "I offered to join ticket if they would be willing to concede the election if Dems deliver on permanent ceasefire and arms embargo. The idea being use Stein's margin in three swing states to compel those concessions. If we truly believe the Dems would never concede, then there's nothing to lose. It also makes clear to those eager to throw Palestinians, Arab Americans, and American Muslims under the bus that if they lose to Trump, they are the source of their own loss. The Green Party rejected this as they're accountable to their broader base and the health of their party. I understand that, but my priority in this moment is doing everything we can to end genocide by using all the leverage we have," Professor Noura Erekat said. Your response to that, Dr. Stein?
Yes. Let me say that ending the genocide in Gaza is not a quick fix. In the words of Frederick Douglass, power concedes nothing without a demand. It never has and it never will. The Green Party is here to continue to exert that pressure. Simply extracting a promise before an election is a very precarious thing to do. The Democrats might agree for a period of a week, and then they might find, oh, circumstances made us go back to continuing this war. So you really do not want to unilaterally disarm in this kind of situation. It would be extremely ineffective. More power to Noura Erekat for being the powerhouse voice that she is. Some of us have been, shall we say, in the political game for quite some time and have had time to observe how these various strategies do and don't work. And extracting a simple concession without, you know, without a permanent guarantee is a very risky proposition, especially because as an independent third party, the obstacles to gaining ballot status are so enormous that if you simply lay down your arms and you give up on the race, you lose your ballot status, and you lose it across the board in a way that you will not gain it back. By continuing to run for office, we maintain our ballot status, and we are able to continue to apply pressure against this very reckless and dangerous empire, which is a problem not only in Gaza, you know, but throughout the Middle East and around the world. We're currently engaged right now in two hot wars on the verge of going nuclear, and another third Cold War on the verge of becoming hot.
Let me ask you another question. It doesn't make sense
to surrender on it all.
I'm just hurrying because we don't have that much time, but New York Democratic Congress member Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was asked in a recent Instagram Live about voting for the Green ticket in November. This is what she said.
What I have a problem with is the fact that if you are running for president, you are the de facto leader of your party. And first of all, trust me on this. I run as a third party candidate in New York. I'm also run as a Working Families Party candidate in addition to running as a Democrat. Because trust me, I've been on record that about my criticisms of a two-party system. So this is not about that. But you are the leader of your party. And if you run for years and years and years and years and years in a row, and your party has not grown, and you don't add city council seats, and you don't add down ballot candidates, and you don't add state electeds, that's bad leadership. And that, to me, is what's upsetting. And all you do is show up once every 4 years to speak to people who are justifiably pissed off, but you're just showing up once every 4 years to do that, you're not serious. You're not authentic. To me, it does not read as authentic. It reads as predatory.
So that's New York Democratic Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Dr. Jill Stein, your response.
So, first of all, we don't go away between presidential elections. What goes away is the media coverage. And I'm sorry, you know, if you're only tuned into mainstream media and believe the propaganda that we go away. No, we're here. We are working. We are doing the work. We have elected actually some 1,500 local officials over the last two decades or so. We currently have 150 local electeds. We have to run at the national level. Unfortunately, because of the rules that Democrats and Republicans make, those rules require us, in order to maintain our ballot status and to run as Greens at lower levels, we actually have to run in many states at the presidential level. So this isn't a choice that we have. Furthermore, you can't compare Greens, which are a people-powered party under attack, above all by the Democrats, to the Working Families Party, which is really not a third party. It is a second ballot line for Democrats, either for current Democrats or for independents on their way to becoming Democrats. As such, they are not under attack by the Democratic Party. And what destroys third parties, and by the way, the Greens are the giant among third parties, so compare us to all other true people-powered third parties. We are the only ones that manage to fight again and, you know, live for another day to continue the fight. And when you're fighting on such a very steeply tilted playing field, it requires building quite a head of steam in order to build support. And over the three races that I have run, and AOC is wrong on that, I was not running every 4 years. I didn't run last time. But it's very important that the party keep up its momentum in order to now be recognized as the alternative to the parties of war and Wall Street. So it's not like we're standing still. We're actually under enormous pressure that has essentially killed all other small parties, whether you look at the Labor Party that was launched at around the same time that the Greens were, the Peace and Freedom Party, which only got as far as 14 ballot lines across the country. They've been beaten back to just two. The Socialist Parties, which used to be on the ballot all over the country, they've been beaten back to just a city council here or there. They do not have national ballot status anywhere except for PSL, which Party of Socialism and Labor and Liberation, which has it only in California. So true third parties, which are people-powered, which do not take their marching orders from the war machine, from AIPAC, from Big Pharma, we play on a very different playing field that AOC is not familiar with. And I'll just conclude my comments. The nickname that my running mate actually gave to AOC is AOC Pelosi. What exactly is she doing with the battles that she has won? That's why we're in this race, so that we can truly serve the critical and dire needs of the American people.
Yeah, I'd like to bring in a Professor Butch Ware to the conversation. Professor, can you tell us why you decided to join the Green Party and run as a vice presidential nominee?
Yeah, when tagged into the fight by my sister soldier, Dr. Jill Stein, it was an easy decision to make. I had conducted an Instagram Live with her on my social media platform. I asked Dr. Jill about reparations after having recently posted a video of Kamala Harris where she hemmed and hawed and shucked and jived for two full minutes and then said the exact words, "I will never do anything that only helps black people." So when I asked Dr. Jill Stein about the question of reparations, she said they behave as though it's in calculable, but it's been calculated many times. It's between $10 and $13 trillion U.S., and I am in favor of cash payments. When I asked Dr. Jill about her resistance to this genocide in Gaza, I said that all of my colleagues in the activist and academic communities that are Palestinian liberation, not just advocates, but people that live this, breathe this, have skin in the game and have suffered, they were all voting for Dr. Jill Stein. So I didn't actually ask Dr. Jill about her support for Palestine. I'd seen her arrested at a pro-Palestine, a Free Palestine rally. I asked her about her overall foreign policy. policy. And when I asked her about her overall foreign policy, her response was to say the approach of the Green Party is to dismantle the American empire. And I said in that interview, as a lifelong committed student of and exponent of and teacher of the Black radical tradition, yeah, and you better hurry up and do it quick before somebody else does it for you, because those two processes look very different. Pulling back those 700 military bases out of the 800 that we have around the world that actually serve no purpose except to antagonize local populations, and then, you know, slowly withdrawing from those other non-strategic positions in ways that keep Americans safe, that allows you to reinvest the $1 trillion, or really $1.3 trillion if you take all the auxiliary costs that are now being spent on the endless war machine. And it allows you to reinvest those things in social housing, in healthcare, in fixing the roads, in doing all of the things that the American government could do for the American populace. So when I was pulled invited into the struggle against imperialism, into the struggle against white supremacy, into the struggle against capitalist exploitation, in my time, after having spent a lifetime teaching about this tradition, writing about this tradition, engaging this tradition at an activist level and as a community organizer, it was an easy decision. And before I even go any further, I just have to observe a moment of silence for Imam Marcellus Khalifa Williams, who was put to death yesterday by this corrupt imperialist state. And we heard nothing from the Black woman who seeks to lead this country into the next phase, right? We heard nothing from the Biden-Harris regime, people who could at least speak, even if there isn't an immediate federal mechanism for clemency. We have a massive void of moral leadership in this country. And the last thing that I'll say by way of introducing myself to the American people on this particular program is that every effort to protect Team Blue, to protect the Democrats from facing accountability for the evil that their own hands have wrought is equally evil. If you are trying to shield them from the electoral consequences of 200,000 plus deaths in Gaza, the electoral consequences of 11 months of genocide, of increasing police murders in every single year since they have been in power, in sending troops in riot gears in Democratic-controlled cities, Democratic-controlled states, to crack kids' heads like they did at UCLA, like they sent troops in riot gear to my own campus at UCSB, then you are part of the problem. Wake up and unplug from the propaganda machine. Everyone is fear-mongering around Trump as though fascism is not already here. So I have entered this fight alongside a lifetime humanitarian, peace activist, ecological conservationist, and moral leader, Jill Stein, in order to shake America out of its stupor. You have more choices than just blue militarized fascism or red militarized fascism. You can actually vote your conscience, vote green. And the last thing that I'll say is that, as Dr. Jill alluded to, the Democrat Party has already lost the swing states of Michigan, Georgia, and Pennsylvania. Institute for Social Policy and Understanding, ISPU, has publicly available data that the Democrats certainly saw before I saw it, that indicates that in the swing states of Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Georgia, that Joe Biden received 65% of the vote in 2020, and the Democrats are polling under 15% in those states now. They could not have won the election without those swing states, and they could not have won those swing states without Muslim voters. Those voters are gone. They are not coming back. Dead man walking. The Democrats cannot win. And Dr. Jill and our host, Amy, have already cited the CARE study, but Yakin Institute will release this week, and I've been privy to this because of my long-term connections inside the Muslim community as a Black Muslim man myself, that over 53% of the Muslims that they surveyed nationwide are now supporting third-party candidates, with something like 80% of those going to the Green Party, that the support for the Democrats in the Muslim community community is at 15%, and it's at 4% for Trump. So this effort to try to pin an inevitable defeat of the Democrats upon third-party candidates or upon Muslims is at best disingenuous, and for those that with a clear sense of moral integrity, it is obviously gaslighting.
A last question to Dr. Stein, and we just have 30 seconds. You grew up in a Zionist household. How do you respond to those who say that anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism as a Jewish presidential candidate? Just 30 seconds.
Yeah, so in brief, when I hear people equating anti-genocide, the resistance to genocide, saying that that is anti-Semitism, in my view, that is the most anti-Semitic thing one could possibly say to imply that it's anti-Jewish to oppose genocide. Zionism and Judaism are very different. Zionism has been controversial within Judaism for much of the lifetime of Zionism. Zionism is a political ideology. It is not Judaism. And Gaza is not a war between Jews and Muslims. It is a war by Zionists on Jews, Muslims, and Christians.
Jill Stein, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Green Party presidential candidate, and Butch Ware, Green Party vice presidential nominee, a professor at University of California, Santa Barbara. Next up, Juan Gonzalez on the past, present, and power of Mexicans in Chicagoland. Stay with us. Mexican Nation by Sones de Mexico Ensemble in Chicago. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show with a major new report on Chicago, where one in five people identify as Mexican. But they've been largely overlooked from politics to pop culture to academia until now. Our own Juan Gonzalez co-wrote the report Fuerza Mexicana, the past, present, and power of Mexicans in Chicagoland. Juan, talk about the significance of this report. You've just come off of a week of presenting it from legislators throughout Illinois to all sorts of politicians and people on the ground in Chicago.
Yes, Amy. Well, as a part of the Great Cities Institute at the University of Illinois Chicago, we were asked by a group of Mexican leaders of nonprofit organizations in the city to try to put together data specifically on the Mexican community, not the general Latino community, because unfortunately, most of the data collected by government agencies and research studies are under the umbrella of Hispanics or Latinos, and those are people from more than 20 different countries in Latin America, and they generally don't zero in on the specific condition of each of these ethnic groups. And the reality is that the Mexican community in the United States represents about 60% of all Latinos, but in places like Chicago, it's up to 75% of all the Latinos in the Chicago area are of Mexican descent. Yet there's no data on what the condition of the Mexican community specifically is. So we tried to put together in this report the first attempt specifically to disaggregate data among Latino communities and focus on the Mexican community in particular. And we issued the report actually last week on the anniversary of Mexican independence, September 16th. But it also has another significance in Chicago specifically, because it was 70 years ago last week on September 16th, 1954, that the federal government launched Operation Wetback in Chicago. It had been launched in the Southwest earlier, but on that day, the INS swept through the city of Chicago, grabbing up Mexicans wherever they could to initiate a mass deportation. And if it sounds familiar, it's because this has happened repeatedly throughout U.S. history of mass deportations of Mexicans, beginning with the Hoover administration in the 1930s, the Eisenhower administration in 1954, then the Bush administration with their raids in the early 2000s, the Obama administration with their mass deportations. So this has been a regular feature of American history. So we issued it on that day specifically to say, look, all of these mass deportations have occurred, and yet the Mexican community in the United States has continued to grow and has become pivotal. So I think the key things that there's a lots of data in the report for people who are into the nerds that are into data. But I think the major issues that we try to present is, one, that the Mexican community of Chicagoland, which is more than 1.5 million people, is not a new community. It's actually been in existence for more than 100 years, especially in the city of Chicago, and that has been critical to the vibrancy of Chicago, especially in the post-industrial age, when the manufacturing declined. It was really the growth of the Mexican community that allowed Chicago to have experienced an enormous renaissance. And just to give an example of the level of involvement of the Mexican community in Chicago's renaissance, for example, today, 51% of all the construction laborers in Chicago are of Mexican origin. So all of those skyscrapers and condominiums that have been refurbished and rebuilt have been built on the backs of low-paid construction laborers of Mexican origin. 71% of the landscapers in the city are of Mexican origin. 49% of the carpenters, 44% of all the cooks in the hotels and the restaurants, 56% of all the auto mechanics in Chicago are of Mexican origin, and 36% of the factory workers, that is those who are still working in factories in Chicago, are of Mexican origin. So really the character of the Chicago working class has dramatically changed and is heavily Mexican. And in fact, there's an entire brown belt within Chicago of a dozen neighborhoods on the southwest side that are over majority Mexican. So there's been, in effect, Mexican migration saved Chicago. And unlike cities like Detroit or Indianapolis or Cleveland that also experienced post-industrial decline but never welcomed in large numbers of Latinos, by Chicago welcoming in Latinos, specifically Mexicans, it has been able to revitalize itself. So I think that's one of the key things. The other thing that's important to understand is the dispersion of the Mexican population. Two-thirds of all of the Mexicans, of those 1.5 million Mexicans, are not in the city of Chicago. They're in the suburbs and in the collar counties of Chicago. And there are now more than a dozen suburban towns around Chicago that have more than 50% Latino populations, yet they have no Latino elected officials at the mayoralty levels or proportionally in the city councils. So the future of political representation and power of the Mexican and Latino community is really in the suburbs of Chicago. And that's true in cities across the country. It is in the suburbs that are the growth areas. The other important thing is that because the community is so young, the college age population has dramatically changed. 32% of all the college and graduate professional school students in Chicago are Latino, 32,000 of them, including 20,000 Mexicans, which means that's the future of higher education for not only Chicago, but for many cities across the country. So these are just some of the findings that we had in this report.
Juan, we're going to link to your report. Juan Gonzalez co-wrote the report, Fuerza Mexicana, the past, present, and power of Mexicans in Chicagoland, for the Great Cities Institute at UIC. That does it for our show. Juan is also the author of Harvest of Empire, History of Latinos in America. Happy birthday, Hannah Elias. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC. Take a look at our program lineup at cjsf.ca to discover the diverse range of contents we bring to you.
Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Radio Rewind. The following content has previously aired on CJSF. But don't worry, we'll be back next week with fresh content. CJSF 90.1 FM. Diverse. Independent. Yours.